Once upon a time, toward the end of the Mud Age, there lived two beautiful nymphs named Scylla and Charybdis. By nymphs, we mean babes heavy on the pulchritude, not the larval form of jellyfish, silverfish and grasshoppers.
Jellyfish nymphs.
One day, a fisherman turned sea god named Glaucus got the hots for Scylla. However, she was not attracted to someone who, frankly, looked like the consequence of a one-night stand between a lard crab and a pile of kelp. Plus, he smelled ranker than Randy Coelacanth. But Glaucus was not to be denied. He asked the goddess Circe for a love potion. She obliged...
Potion?
Potion.
Love patient.
Patience. Potion. She obliged... But later, blaming it on a woefully antediluvian herbal database, she mixed up a brew of pure poison that turned Scylla into a six-headed snaky monster with a bad temper. Charybdis was once a cutie pie nymph daughter of Poseidon, god of water and horses. Although she preferred the equestrian side of his business, he forced her to work a dull middle management job in his water department. Well, it was an era dominated by gods and goddesses. There were no nymph rights.
No nymph bill of rights?
None bill of nymph rights.
Nymph of rights.
It was her job to flood the lands for her dad's underwater kingdom. Then the earth entered into an eons-long period of drought. Eventually, Zeus, king of the gods, instituted severe water restrictions. But at the behest of her father, Charybdis continued to flood the lands, grudgingly disobeying the official decree. Zeus was incensed. He couldn't scold Poseidon, who was his brother, so instead he punished his daughter, turning her into a passive-aggressive monster whirlpool and sticking her in a cave on one side of the Strait of Messina, opposite Scylla.
Have you been watching some old movies recently?
No, but I remember Harry... who's the fellow who did all the special effects in the early 1970s?
I don't remember.
You can look it up on IMDb.
I will. I was thinking that this sounded an awful lot like the one that Bernard Herrmann wrote the music for. What was the name of that one? With the dancing skeletons?
Yes, that's this fellow that whose name escapes
me. What was the
name
of the movie?
The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad.
No, not that one.
No, the Sixth Voyage of Sinbad.
Close enough.
Something. At first, the two former hotties, angry at their unjust fates, railed at one another. But later they decided to channel their resentment and work together. They made plying the Strait of Messina shipping lanes a risky business indeed. Time inexorably passed. Uncountable sailors and mermen were snatched from the sea and killed in the most gruesome manner imaginable. But eventually, the two monsters mellowed. First, they merely drowned or decapitated their...
Sounds like a dance. The monster mellow.
The monster mellow. First, they merely drowned or decapitated their victims. Then they allowed a few sailors to escape their clutches unharmed. Soon thereafter, they quit the terrorizing business altogether. But they both needed jobs. For sure, they couldn't get by on their good looks. Charybdis's brief foray into animal husbandry gave her an idea, and Scylla immediately approved of it. And so, on the northern shore of Sicily in the year 850,000 BC, they opened Barbarigma, the world's first restaurant. Having slaughtered sailors for as long as she could remember, Scylla was a natural at the butchering end of the business. That left Charybdis free to focus on decor, waitstaff, and menu planning. They both agreed that Barbarigma was to be a meat-eater's paradise, and the menu reflected the diversity of the mythological creatures that frequented the area. So, can you tell where I was last night?
No. A restaurant?
Nah, I guess you can't.
No.
Centaurs, Griffins, chimeras, minotaurs, sphinxes, unicorns, they all found their way onto a dinner plate in the form of a savory chop, cutlet, sausage, shepherd's pie, blood pudding, and the occasional meat tart.
Now it sounds like Mary Rawls' big party up in the...
Ah, that was it, yes.
The one of the charred venison.
Charred venison, ah. And there was no shortage of customer base. Mortals long subjugated by these monsters lined up in droves to enjoy a flambéed or sautéed pound of their flesh. The restaurant did so well that plans were made to franchise the business, but one unfortunate incident scuttled that idea. During a morning meeting one day, Charybdis told Scylla that demand was rapidly beginning to exceed supply. Sphinxes had mysteriously started to evolve into sphincters, and griffins had disappeared from the vicinity altogether.
So the concept is just marvelous.
So Scylla got in her car and drove down to Hades. Her aim was to implore Pluto, the ruler of the underworld, to donate some carcasses to the restaurant. She could see them piled by the hundreds just inside the gates. However, Hades was guarded by Cerberus, a monster. There are too many of those sounds.
Right.
Hades
and misspellings.
Where?
First one.
Which one?
Charybdis.
Charybdis?
Yeah.
See, look up there. Oh, there's... Aha.
Charybdis.
All right, well, we do need that spell checker once in a while. Yes.
Ancient Greek spell checker. I've got one of those.
Oh, good. Yes. Anyway, Cerberus, the monster's three-headed dog, had set up such a racket with his barking and baying that her suppressed bad temper suddenly kicked in, and she gunned the car and ran him over. While Cerberus burgers were a huge hit back on Earth, down below, Pluto was furious at the loss of his pooch, and he was keen to exact revenge. He summoned Medusa, the snake-haired gorgon who had eyes that, if looked into, turned the beholder to stone, and turned her into a food inspector. Medusa visited Borborygma on a Saturday and ordered the daily special, Unicorn Dogs. You want to give the little blurb of the Unicorn Dogs?
The little blurb of the Unicorn Dogs, yes. Unicorn dogs are batter-dipped slivers of succulent meat, roasted to perfection and served in the animal's unique spiral horn.
According to the menu's blurb, it was so tasty that Medusa was tempted to order seconds, but she had a job to do. She retrieved a little animatronic cockroach from her purse, jammed it into the bottom of the unicorn's horn, and activated it. It wriggled and buzzed crossly, attracting the dyspeptic attention of nearby trenchermen. When Charybdis came out to see why her restaurant was abruptly hemorrhaging patrons, Medusa triumphantly held up the cockroach wrapped in a writ of restaurant condemnation and closure. Charybdis stared at the writ, then she stared at Medusa. Instantly,
bad move. Yep.
She turned to Chalcedony. Watching from the kitchen, Scylla recognized the Gorgon's snake hair curling out from under her adobe hat. Unnerved, she gulped a beaker of curdled cream as Medusa turned to gaze at her. Due to the high level of lactose in her system, Scylla turned to Scylla Bob. Soon thereafter, the waitstaff fled and the restaurant closed. If there's a moral there, it isn't clear to the proprietors of Calvus and Damien's 483rd New Music Bazaar. Better to just get on with the program and look for logic later, or at least for Calvus.
And Calvus will look for the split infinitive instead.
Why, there's always one challenge you.
I love to find them. I love to see them, especially when they're so close to the end when I'm paying attention again. Well, we're listening to some Noah Krzyzewski, appropriate to this particular essay today. It's called I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now. We'll listen to the rest of that. Be right back.
Thank you.
Noah Krzyzewski from the Noah Krzyzewski Songbook. I think you made that up.
Well, maybe, but he deserves one.
It's a private release, including Psalm 23, Jubilate Cantiga, and this one, I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now. We love Noah Krzyzewski stuff mm-hmm. here. There's just mm-hmm. something, I don't know, unusually provocative about.
Krzyzewski-kin.
Crescendo-like. Yes.
Any bearing on the guest for today?
Yes, in fact. Maggie Payne is our guest. We're going to be starting that interview early, in fact, because it is a little longer than usual.
Long in the tooth?
And it's got some long music in the tooth as well. And since she is, by and large, an electroacoustic composer, we're going to hear all of that kind of stuff along with her interview. She's funny. She does her own radio show out in San Francisco.
Oh, does she?
Yeah, so she was all sort of radioed up for me. She was ready. She didn't stumble like me. You know, she was professional. I don't think there were any uhs coming out of her mouth. And she also does all kinds of interesting stuff, mm-hmm. including audio restorations. She's Mills College, big Cayuga out there.
And she's been there for how long?
Since 1970. Yeah, a long time. And she talks about classic synths and all kinds of amazing stuff. So I think, because we won't get a chance to hear large quantities of her music, just several longer pieces, we'll start right out with a little bit from her version 2.1, a piece from 1987. A little bit of that, and then we'll jump right into the interview. You ready? It's Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar on the road. And we're about to be intimidated, as is usual for Calvos and Damien, because, you know, we're in the non-academic world and we just don't have any of the terminology. And in front of us, we have Maggie Payne, who knows everything about everything, and we're scared.
Wrong.
Welcome to Calvos and Damien.
Thank you. And don't forget that Mills College, although termed academia, is kind of probably the wildest place there is, and I have to admit, fairly unacademic in what we do. We love the cutting edge, the wildest people, the people who don't fit anywhere else. And we like some of those who actually do fit elsewhere, but mostly we're kind of outsiders and, you know, the outlaws.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
We have, of course, Damien and I have never actually been there. We've never seen it. But every time we talk to someone, at some point, mm-hmm. their orbit has touched Mills College.
Oh, yeah.
So although this is sort of unusual for our show, we rarely ask this question. We're going to ask you, what is it? What is it about? Why are people attracted there? What do you do there?
I think it's, it's in the Bay Area, which is an incredible place to be. Not only can you find, you know, 10 restaurants in certain blocks, you know, of all different nationalities, but you can also find music of every different nationality every day of the week. So if you feel like Peruvian music one night, you can either just go out on the doorstep or, you know, you can find a spot somewhere in this area. It's going to be happening. But in terms of Mills specifically, there are several aspects to it. And one is I think that we've for so long had such an experimentalist tradition. Henry Cowell, John Cage, Lou Harrison in his own way. You know, it's very experimental. It's just what we do.
but how do people make their way to Mills? I mean, we have talked to composers who just come out here for a brief time. Mm-hmm. Some who come out, I remember we talked to Kaya Sarriaho,
and
she was out here for a while and just said what she loved was sitting watching the Surfer Boys and working. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I have never gone to a college where it's possible to watch the Surfer Boys.
Well,
okay.
Mills, you can't do that because we're in Oakland. no surf.
But that's what she said, and I was totally confounded by it. But still, there was something about the attitude that she loved.
Yeah.
And so what, for example, would bring someone like Kaya Sarriaho 7,500 miles from Europe?
Well, actually, I don't think she came to Mills specifically, but, you know, people like David Tudor and, certainly Morton Subotnick was there for a long time, and Pauline Oliveros, and, you know, Alvin Curran, Fred Frith, Ben Johnston years ago.
Yeah, sure.
And just so many exciting people.
Just to talk to other people, be with other people, work with other people?
Yeah, of course, Robert Ashley,
sure,
David Berman,
sure.
David Rosenboom, Larry Plansky, the list goes on and 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 on. And it's just such an exciting place to be. Mm-hmm. And we, for students who come in, we accept students whose portfolios we really like and who, you know, we think they really have something special to say, and it's very much their own. It's not a clone of something else.
Okay.
It's not anything like this. Yeah. And they really get into trouble if they start trying to sound like any of us.
Ah.
That's the last thing we want. You know, we want them to develop their voice. The reason why we have them here is to give them room to spread their wings and to learn new and exciting and different and to go intermedia, to do work with dancers, to work with artists, to do art themselves, to dance themselves, to experience it all. Yeah.
How long have you been there yourself?
Oh, okay.
Well, never mind.
No, 1970. On the advice of Gordon Mumma, I was at University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. I got a master's degree in flute. There, applied flute, back in 1969-70. And he said, man, you should just check this place out. You know, it's really cool. I got admitted to the, you know, I was able to continue at Illinois, but you know, it just sounded so interesting to be out here. So I came here in 70 and got a degree in 72. Yeah.
And you've stayed, and you are now...
I can't see a reason to leave.
Sort of,
you know,
running the show?
Well, no, there are a lot of people running that show. And some really good people. Chris Brown is co-director of the Center of Contemporary Music with me as well. And we have an incredible faculty.
You're one of the few guests we've had on Calvis and Damien who looks like her picture.
That picture's 20 years old.
It's astounding. I wondered, you know, because so many people provide us with these wonderful old pictures, and then they come in the studio, and we're kind of shocked.
Hard to
and
recognize
stunned.
Them.
And you look just like your picture.
Well,
it's
thank you.
That,
you're so flattering and wonderful. Thank you. You can lie all you want.
Oh, well, I wasn't, actually. That's just I actually did some pre-research and asked about whether you still looked like your picture. And I assured me you did, and I said, that's not true. Couldn't
I think that's just because I never cut my hair.
So let's talk about you and your music. You said you have this flute degree early on. When did you start in music, per se?
Well, you want to go way back? Okay.
Well, the quick précis from way back, and then into how you got into being into composition.
So hang on. Okay, when I was very young, my parents tried to do the right thing, and they taught, you know, piano lessons and all the stuff. I hated it.
And where were you?
Amarillo, Texas. Okay. Up in the panhandle of Texas. Actually, it was a good place to be raised. I was very happy there. Desert, you know, really nice. When I was 9, somehow I heard a flute. Someone playing flute, and I said, yes, that's what I want to do. And I was right, that's what I wanted to do, and I did it then, and I'm still doing it. I have to admit that I had some really wonderful teachers who actually said, okay, it's okay to develop those whistle tones. It's okay to hum while you play. It's okay to, you know, blow air through your flute and have fun with it. That was, you know, when I was 9 years old, and that's pretty amazing.
That's unusual for being...
Yeah, and stuck in the middle of that.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So, yeah, I think I just had such an interest in timbre from the very beginning, and it still runs, threads through everything I do. My dad also, he was a doctor, but he was also kind of interested in technology. He made the mistake, of buying me a tape machine.
Oh, yeah.
When I was about 10 or 11. Because we lived in we weren't actually in the city limits. We were way out, you know, and there was nobody around. So this enabled me to play, you know, one line of a flute duet, and then I could play back and play it. And later, as things progressed and we got sound on sound and all this stuff, this was a long time ago.
Sure.
We're talking 50s, right?
Sure.
Then I could record all the parts of the Bach B minor flute sonata and then bump them down an octave so they were in the right register, and all this stuff was sound on sound on sound.
Interesting.
I was hooked.
Isolated ritual that so many composers went through in their own bedrooms.
Oh,
I've spoken to so many who said, I got a tape recorder when I was 10 years old, and it seems to have been this sort of the secret addiction of
Well, I didn't think about it until later, but when I looked back on it, I knew that my dad thought he would give me this and he would look to be so wonderful and all this stuff, and that I would just not use it or something. You know, and then he would get it.
And he would get it.
But he was dead wrong. I have to say, another influence along the way was my incredible brother, who was 3 years older, and he was into electronics from day one. He built his own Heathkit stuff. He built a whole ham radio operator's station, and he was one of the youngest kids to ever get in. He built his own oscilloscopes. He built all this great stuff. And, you know, I loved it. He built his own Tesla coil. And
you took up the soldering iron back then yourself?
No, I didn't. I didn't have that opportunity until later, and I died right in there. I really loved it.
And so you made the decision to go to Illinois
actually,
or was there an intervening
step? Well, let's see. Music in Texas was really strong. We just had it. From kindergarten all up, you know, and certainly junior high school played in all the competitions like crazy, and all the solo competitions, quartet, ensembles, blah, 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 and also playing the symphony since I was 14, and all these wonderful opportunities, and also went to Interlochen for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
So I learned that there's a world out there. It's really interesting.
The world beyond Amarillo.
And no, I'm not staying in Texas. So my parents would not allow me to go to a conservatory because they thought I should be a little bit broader in scope. really didn't help because, of course, I really focused on music very strongly when I went to Northwestern University and studied there, and I loved it. It was, you know, just north of Chicago.
Did you go right into music? You just...
I mean, I'm sure there was some waffling somewhere along the way, but not really.
Tearful goodbyes from your parents as you were going off to what they didn't want you to do.
Yeah, well, let's not go into there. Northwestern was great. I just had this incredible flute teacher, Walfred Kujala. He was so fine, a player and such a thorough musician, and he taught me so much about composition. It was remarkable. And, you know, he would teach me Bach, and I taught him Berio's Sequenza.
So you were...
In return. I'd play...
We missed a step in here.
I played contemporary music all the way through junior high and high school.
When did you start making up your own?
Well, I think I was... the minute I started playing.
Okay, yeah, so you're...
But I was really lucky to have, you know, stuck out there in the sticks, still wonderful teachers who introduced me to, you know, Vrez Density 21.5 when I was still in junior high school. You know, Allgaier,
Density being one of the sort of those classic pieces that if you are going to become a composer or, in this case, contemporary flutist, you encounter that piece and it changes your life.
Absolutely. And when I was at Northwestern, I got in an improvisation group. There were four of us. Elise Ross, who was a singer, incredible singer, and a composer, and Dan Stepner, who's a violinist, and Peter Tuckas, who's an incredible pianist. He's now at Oberlin. Yeah. And so we improvised like crazy all the time. It was wonderful, in addition to all the symphony playing and all that stuff. Did all the stuff you're supposed to do, but also did so much new music. And then I went off to Yale for a semester. It was a little too stodgy for me.
Well, I would.
No
I'm
offense
not
to Yale.
I mean, we'll go on to the East Coast. It's certainly different.
I love the East Coast. It was wonderful. But I was just looking for something.
Yeah.
I was looking for something a little. I really wanted to immerse in contemporary music. So I ended up waiting. I was there a semester. Went back to Milwaukee. I stayed with a friend in Milwaukee for a little bit longer. And then I went to University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana.
Hi, I'm Laurie Anderson, and you're listening to California's New Music Bazaar, your one stop for non-pop, the most local of the non-pop international networks.
Here on WGDR Plainfield.
She already did the flagship bit, didn't she? Or did she?
What?
I couldn't tell if she said...
She said the most local of...
Of the flagship.
Yeah, she didn't know how international we were at
the
time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our little T-shirt didn't tell her anything.
Mm-hmm. But it just has the barcode, isn't that
right? It's not the barcode of the non-pop international network.
Oh, yes. Yes, how soon one forgets.
Nonpopradio.com or here directly to our site at calvos.org, K-A-L-V-O-S, calvos.org or calvos.com
or
calvos.net.
Or newmusicbazaar.com. .com.
Or .org.
But no .net.
I have it, but I haven't hooked that one up yet just because I figured I might use it to sell stuff instead.
Yes.
All right, never mind.
We need to sell.
Yeah, back to Maggie Payne, and in about 7 minutes we'll actually be playing some of Maggie's music.
Or you could even do it underneath.
Nah.
Which was hot.
And that was the sort of the height of who was there at the time?
Well, like Sal Mataronno, Ben Johnston, I mean, come on.
Great.
Ed London conducting, and, you know, it was great with the contemporary music ensemble we had. We were so busy, all of us, that I do remember one rehearsal that the only time we could rehearse was 3 in the morning. And so the whole group met at 3 in the morning to rehearse these pieces. But I was averaging 6 concerts a week. Working with incredible dancers, Al Wong in particular, but many, many others. Gordon Mumma was there that year, so he's just terrific. Just an incredible person and an incredible composer and a great mind, so... It was an extremely stimulating year. James Beauchamp, incredible, absolutely incredible, taught acoustics, loved it. And that was my first introduction really to the Moog synthesizer and to a classical recording studio. And I was
Which
hooked.
Is something, in terms of recording studio, something you do today. We'll get to that. Let's listen to something of yours so we have an opportunity to hear what you're something about the person we're talking to.
What you doing?
Apparent Horizon is one that's been heard on the show a number of times, so I think we should hear that again. And maybe you could give us your own personal first-hand introduction instead of all the lies we've told.
Oh, okay. I'll make up a few of my own. Is this what you're saying? Okay. Apparent Horizon. There's a visual component to Apparent Horizon.
Yes.
So put on your space eyes and desert eyes and think about those beautiful places and how you feel when you're in those spaces. And the video shot for this piece, it took about 6 years of various trips to the desert. I love the desert. I'm a truly desert rat. I don't like it when it's really hot, but the sheer beauty of it, the vast expanses, and yet the incredible detail, every little gully, every little plant is so meaningful, every little sound. It's so quiet there, and it's a little scary because you're addressing, like, yourself, your innermost, you know, like, whoa. you think, you know, it's really
scary. For our local broadcast audience who may never have been there, this may seem like an exaggeration, but it is absolutely the truth. Mm-hmm. Something happens in the desert which is quite different from the sort of what I call the green slime of the East, which is you know, full of some kind of a richness that is in the way.
Yeah.
And the desert strips that away, and so that when you see a plant in front of you,
it's amazing.
It's like the only plant in the world.
Right. I mean, it's like this intense thing, or the rocks, or the tiny gullies, or the cracks in the earth, or the tiniest little bit of insects that you might hear, or a peregrine falcon, you know, zooming over, or whatever. Everything is like has intense meaning. I mean, it's just so strong, right? And you look up at the stars, and it's like you could pluck them from the skies. They're so bright. They're so right there. So anyway, I guess that tells enough about the desert. But I did these shots where it was either like panning from one shot across to reveal something about this landscape, right? Like Monument Valley, like going across, and all these formations, or the canyon lands, or Bryce Canyon, or whatever, and the desert in the snow, all this stuff, you know. And so I would be either in a tight shot and zoom out, sort of revealing the context, or the inverse, or again a pan or something. But when I started to put that video together, it was extremely boring. I started thinking, you know, what I would really love is the desert from above. And, you know, I just didn't have the financial resources to go rent a plane and go out there and do it, and all the steady cam and all that stuff that you have to have. So I got in touch with NASA, and I just took every resource they had of from the space shuttle flights and Apollo missions, all that footage they had, and I went through every single one, hours and hours and hours, and picked certain segments that I then incorporated into this piece. And kind of interesting at times, it's difficult to distinguish where these NASA footage comes in versus the desert shots I took. For the music, I took sounds from some of these NASA tapes, right? I took sounds from satellite broadcasts of them, of astronauts repairing various satellites or whatever up in space. And I took a lot of shortwave broadcasts. So it was all from signals that had somehow gone through space. Okay. And the stuff I liked the best was not speech. It was when everything broke up, when there was not what for humans is intelligibility.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that information is so rich. It's so intriguing.
Your desert, again.
Yeah,
the,
right. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's, you know, there's a lot of just crackling and things. And I transformed all this using SoundHack and whatever I could get my hands on, a lot of equalization and stuff to sort of make these into what I'm always calling kind of otherworldly sounds, or things that remind me of what it tried to remind me of what it felt like sitting in that desert all by myself, whenever, whatever, and all those things that you deal with in that situation. And also sort of in the back of my mind, hopefully kind of what the astronauts might oralize in their heads as they're looking down on this incredible planet. So anyway, I guess you've probably gotten a little of this take that I'm very interested in ecology. So most of these pieces have a lot to do. I think when people see this piece and or even hear it, hopefully they'll get a sense that there's a preciousness to these places, and these are places not where human beings should be. It's fine to visit and to tread lightly and to let it be.
It's a fantastic piece. I recommend that the other distractions you might have in your life you put aside while we listen to it. This is Maggie Payne from 1996?
Yes.
Apparent Horizon. Apparent Horizon by our guest today on Galveston, Damien, Maggie Payne. The interest in ecology, fascinating.
Yeah.
Does this infuse your other work?
Most all of it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why? It's sort of an interesting question, particularly when you look at a piece like, or listen to, since it does have a visual component,
yeah.
I can't use that.
And you've seen it. So.
Yes. When you listen to it, very organic in sound, very mm-hmm. the richness that you've created out of that. But interesting that you use electronic means when you're talking about otherwise natural phenomena. How did you make those decisions?
What else would I do? I'm not gonna. I don't know. I do electronic music, electroacoustic music. I say because most of my early electronic music was purely electronic, you know, Moog synthesized bass and a little Buchla, and then I built my own Aries synthesizer and all
that.
Well,
I guess what I'm getting at is as a player of an acoustic instrument.
Oh yeah, that.
Yeah. Have you sort of separated your sort of compositional electronic kind of life from that in such a way that you've developed your own sound world electronically, and that this flute is something that belongs to others in some respect?
No,
tell me how
it doesn't separate out in that the flute still is a wonderful resource for me, and I still write a lot of flute music. I just did two flute commissions this year. So that was solo flute, so that was a wonderful opportunity. And I do a flute piece every 10 years. It was great to get these commissions this year because it was like, oh, it's right at that 10-year mark, right? It's great. And it's always extended flute techniques and, you know, pushing those boundaries. And, again, the interest in timbre is the thread that ties.
Okay.
Both of these.
It's just
know.
There's just sort of irony because whenever you hear these National Geographic documentaries, my God, that flute comes in whenever there's a mystery of the desert.
Well, yeah, but it actually goes with it. I actually used to always take a recorder with me, and there's a wonderful there's this wonderful tank in Death Valley. I think it's called Salt Wells or something on the West Road. And it was just a tank, and of course I crawled inside. I don't know what it used to carry, but I got two things out of it. One is some beautiful photographs that I took around the sides of this huge holding tank, and the other thing was to go inside and play in there. It was so great because it was so resonant and stuff. But anyway, I know. I do... Where the sounds that I chose for this piece also link to the desert images and all is that... These sounds have something that I wasn't able to get with the electronics I had, which were you could get them really wild and intriguing, constantly changing. But it just seemed to me that the variability in a natural landscape of sound was so very broad and so interesting and so exciting and so very much out of my control. Mm-hmm. You know, in my control, I do go in there and obviously control it because I choose which sounds and what sections of sounds I'll choose. But a lot of it is because of that richness and that ever-changing texture that I just like that to be part of that natural process. And then I work with that, as, you know. Foundation.
I'm sure some of our listeners, we have some irascible listeners that call us now and again. And
I'm glad we're not live.
if I can speak for some of them, they would say, I think there's something that just doesn't make sense about using this artificial electronics to express natural, about natural terminology.
Yeah, but they were, the origin is electroacoustic. The origin is real sound.
Mm-hmm.
It's sound that you hear, you know. So... it's electronically processed, but it's natural. And almost everything that everyone hears these days is electronic music because when you hear your wonderful Mozart string quartets over the air, excuse me, there are electrons involved.
And not only in the reproduction, but
in your
editing
own.
Process and the recording. You name it all, it's from the beginning to the end, from the moment of the...
That's right.
The physical vibration of that string, which might as well be physical algorithm rather.
Yeah. Right. And believe me, I love acoustic music as well. I love music. So, but this is just the direction I'm in right now. And I do. I do write acoustic music a bit too. But yeah, for this piece, yeah, I'm just I've been doing this acoustic origin for quite some time. I love that sound. The capabilities. It's just amazing.
There. Let's go back to your bio because we left off. Gosh, you were in Illinois with some really wonderful folks, and maybe we can hear how your musical loves developed from more of this bio. Pick us up in Illinois.
Oh yeah, University of Illinois, playing six concerts a week.
Yeah, and that's
again,
where we were.
Yeah, and working with wonderful people. I mean, Sal Marano, I loved, and Ben Johnston can make you love any music because he can hear everything in that music and teach you to hear wonderfully. And so, and just playing so much and working with so many people. But also that introduction to, from Jim Beauchamp to the classical studio. I loved it.
What do you mean by the classical studio?
Classical studio, it's oscillators. You move the dial, you change the frequency. You know, you move those pots and you change the frequencies. Yeah, so, yeah.
So you're talking about the ones with the oscillators, the voltage-controlled oscillators and the filters?
Not voltage-controlled.
Okay.
Classical, no. No, this is early. So, no, they didn't have that at all. So you wanted to change the frequency, you change it with your hand. Right, hands on. Okay. And then you splice, right. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's cool. I love it. Just again that ability to change the sound palette, expand it. And when I came to Mills, it was really great. I got there about a week early.
And that was when?
1970.
Okay.
And Bob Ashley and Bill Moraldo opened the door to the little Buchla studio and said, "You're teaching this next week." Close the door. Sort of shoved me inside and closed the door. Learn it. And I did. It was great. And we had a Moog synthesizer as well. That Buchla that I'm talking about is the original Buchla, the prototype that was built for the San Francisco Tape Music Center in the mid-60s that moved to Mills College in 66. And then, hence, it got renamed from the center, San Francisco Tape Music Center, the Center for Contemporary Music. We still have that Buchla. We still have that Moog. I still teach on the Moog.
And so they've been kept in working condition.
You bet.
Yeah. You have a staff of about 40 to replace drying capacitors.
We have one extremely good technical director. Buchla's not quite up and running because I don't use it so much. The Moog is... I would love to, but, you know, it's going to take some work, and there's only so much time for our beleaguered technical director, as great as he is. You know. But the Moog, I teach a class, Intro to Electronic Music, in the fall, and John Bischoff teaches Intro to Computer Music, so I don't want to get in his arena for that. I just want him to get into this Moog synthesizer. It's so great. It doesn't crash. You can make sound from the second you're in that room, right?
And you have classes in this. So uh-huh. You're teaching a technology, a 40-year-old technology, almost as if you were teaching a violin.
30-year-old technology, yeah. 35, man. Right, something like that. Well, no. You know, for these students, they come from all walks of life and all interests, and many of them have never played an instrument before mm-hmm. or anything else. That's just why this is so great. I don't play a single electronic piece for them until very, very close to the end. And by then, they know everything that's going on in those pieces. And they can, in many cases, say, wow, I think mine's kind of better. You know? It's really cool. I'm just trying to keep them as open to everything as possible. And I don't want to have them pattern after anyone or anything.
My question, I guess, was really analog technology in a digital world kind of question.
Yeah. I think it's great. They really get the foundations, you know. Many of them already have synthesizers and stuff, and it's also pre-programmed. They're scared to go in and edit. They don't know what they're doing when they're doing it. So this gives them all the foundation, all the terminology, all what's going on. And I, partway through the class, I start transferring it onto, to the newer devices and stuff, so they see how that terminology moves over and affects the new stuff. So, yeah, it just does transfer over. I mean, it's the foundation, right? I mean, it's where it all starts.
Oh, I mean, I can agree with you, only because I am of, as they say, a certain age.
But they love it, and, you know, there's a great...
They're not confounded by the idea of going back to something that was made long before they were born.
I think they just love it that they can plug inputs to inputs. It's not going to blow up. They can plug outputs to outputs. It's not going to blow up. You know, they can... It doesn't crash. It does not crash. It's just so open and free, and they have to understand the architecture. They're patching. They're understanding signal routing. They're understanding the real fundamentals of how this all works. So, again, when they move on to something else, it also helps them to... I spend quite a bit of time on acoustics, fundamental acoustics, so they really start understanding sound and what they're hearing, and it just really opens up their ears because now they have analytical terms that then now they can actually relate to that, and then they go, wow, nice Doppler, wow. Or they'll, you know, they start really tuning into the world, and it's so wonderful to watch this happen. I love it.
Let's hear something more of yours.
Okay. What would you like? Where are you going?
Any of the above. I think since we have several.
Oh, no, you choose.
All right, let's go.
It's a memory test for you.
Memory test for you. Okay. Well, then.
System test. Fire next.
Oh. That's that one. Okay. Anything on this one you want to know about?
Well, introduce it to our listeners.
Okay. System test also has, fire nice, parenthetically. It also has a visual component, which I'm not going to go into much because I don't want to spoil it. So this is something that's going to stay out there. But let's just say it. Well, no, I'm not going to say anything. Okay.
We'll just play it.
Yeah. No. But the sounds are generated primarily by a Jacob's ladder that I built. I mean,
explain.
It's like less
briefly.
Than 10 seconds to put together. Yeah. Neon transformer, AC. You can use coat hangers. Yeah. And there, you know, it's the transformer, and then you have like the little V that goes up, and you have the from the two antennas, they spread farther apart as you go up, and you plug the thing in.
We've seen it like in like Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like
yeah. And the arc, there's a charge across these two what are those?
Electrodes.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah. Okay. And the arc starts very tight, and this wonderful sound, and it goes up the ladder, and it splits apart at the top because it's too far for that arc to travel. Not enough current to make it zap across. Really great sound. So ozone, you know, it produces a lot of ozone. Mm-hmm. Very dangerous that way. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, after recording it for 5 hours, I go, oh, this smells kind of funny in here. Oh, yeah, I remember ozone poisoning. Yeah. And also, one should not actually touch the two electrodes at the same time, or one might be out, or very unhappy, or not around. I know it's very high. You know,
I recall I was in junior high school when our we had a little earth science or whatever that
wonderful.
Was called many years ago, and we were asked to form a chain of all the students. You can imagine how we exploded apart upon that charge. Yes, hand to hand.
Well, Nick Bertone and I also built a flame speaker at the Exploratorium back in the early 80s. And in that case, 500 volts DC, I think. Or 500, just humongous.
Lots of
yes,
them.
Right.
Lots. More than will fit in your average
two
basket.
Two electrodes in the flame. Poured sound. I mean, it's a complicated circuitry, but sound in there. The feed an electronic source in there. Seed the flame, the plasma, and it's a speaker. It
Stabbing.
Was so amazing. We were teasing about making headphones.
Ooh, ouch.
But, yeah, we got knocked across the room a couple of times on that project.
So back to Fire Nice.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Introducing that.
Yeah,
that
the other thing. Yeah, I'm sorry. So that was the fire component. Okay, the zzz. So this has a lot of that going on, and you will hear it. And a lot of that's, of course, been... you know, SoundHack is such a great program. Thank you, Tom Erb. We adore you. But a lot of convolution and Facebook coding and all that stuff. And also the ice part was I don't know. I just had a glass of ice water sitting there. It started cracking and making all these great sounds. So those happen to be the two sound sources that I use primarily for this piece.
It's here.
And visualize.
And visualize.
Images.
Okay. And back to the concentration level for our listeners. Here we are. Fire up. System Test, Fire and Ice, by our guest on Calvos and Damien, Maggie Payne.
Thank you.
We had a wonderful conversation while we were listening to System Test, Fire and Ice.
We obviously weren't listening. Right?
Well,
we were talking.
Of course we were listening. We're listening in our inner ears, in our inner spaces of the memory of the piece.
We got back on the desert. I'm sorry.
Yes, we did.
It has such a pull. It has such a pull. But if you go to the desert, go to the desert where there aren't people, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, if you go to Bryce Canyon, it's full of people and all this stuff. But there are places you can go. Are times of the year you can visit where you're on your own.
If you want to hike in isolation, you can go into
you could go anywhere, Nevada, just park
anywhere,
your car.
But in somewhere where, you know, there's probably a way back that you won't be found as a skeleton years later, there are places you can go, and Canyonlands is one.
Yeah.
It's
Highway 50.
Yeah, Highway 50.
Highway
right.
50.
Or maybe Utah.
Canyonlands.
But no, the other one.
Bryce
Zion.
In Zion.
Zion.
Yeah.
Zion. You can go to Zion, and Zion's so big that you can go out there for days and days and days and never see another person and have that all fall away from you.
We don't have a travel agency, I promise you.
Oh, yes, the Calvos and Damien Travel Agency. That's what we need. Maggie Payne's our guest, by the way. We didn't say that when we came off hearing.
I have to say, I went to Vermont years ago to Goddard. For something.
I
was stunned with the beauty, though.
Green slime.
Those forests were so beautiful.
Yes,
it was the first time I'd seen anything like that. Yeah, I'm Texan. It was stunning.
A different place.
I know.
Our grasses are always greener or drier or more silent.
Or more full of snow.
Oh, yes, that too. Well, we're back here with you again, and I'm curious as to, in general, how you approach creating a new piece. Everyone is unique. I know you're rolling your eyes like he's asking one of those questions that I can't answer because everything is different. But you've been working, creating things long enough that you're not sort of grabbing at the next thing that you've heard and said, I'm going to do that.
Oh. Yeah, sure. Okay. I think my ears are always open to a fault. You know, it's so distracting. Somebody would be having a conversation with me, and I won't be listening because there's a sound in the room or space. Like, I'm really hearing this computer buzzing. I kind of really like it and stuff, you know, and all this other stuff.
Air machine over there.
Yeah, out there, yeah. But I could, you know, it's just, sounds in the environment, and I've recorded sounds in the environment for years upon years upon years, ever since I was a kid. And we could talk more directly about a particular piece that you'll probably play, which is Fluid Dynamics.
Let's do it.
In that piece, there were two sound sources on the Mills campus that I had wanted, that I'd wanted to nail for a long time. And one was this really squeaky gas valve regulator outside one of the drama department called Lister Hall. And it just goes, you know, you get the rush in the pipes of the gas going in, so, you know, all that stuff. And then there's this little meter thing that goes, you know, it's just really incredible. It has kind of a rhythmic sound. And then it's all changing in there, the underlying gas through the pipes and stuff. And it continues to change, all this stuff. So anyway, it's a great sound. I thought, oh, gosh, maybe I can finally write a piece that has rhythm in it, you know. It had sort of rhythm to it. And then there was this other source at Mills, which is in the men's washroom. And so I spent
And you
that,
frequently
Of course.
Go there.
You know? So it was a faulty washer in the sink. And you know, just banging the pipes like crazy, and I was thinking, oh, great, another rhythm thing I could use. So, you know, of course, when I get it all in my studio, it's in there three hours recording it some night when, thank goodness, no guys were around. And so in my studio, I get in there, and I start doing all the processes I can possibly think, you know, just everything I can possibly think of to do to all this, slowing down, speeding them up, EQ, just get the tiny thread way up top, all this stuff, and I threw it all out. And just did the other sounds that those things were making in their more steady state.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I'm just so hopeless with that, you know.
Rebelling against the sounds themselves.
Well,
the rhythm
thing. I'm just really not so great at it. But so those, you know, they're definitely in there, and I did still use those sources. Oftentimes, you know, it just goes off to other things. I hear something else, and oh, that's cool, or something else gets inadvertently recorded on those because sound, is, of course, never happens in isolation. Mm-hmm. Other sounds, I had just built a studio, an art studio of my own in the back of our house, and I spent all my money building it, and I couldn't put anything in it, not even a chair. I couldn't then go out and buy anything to put in there. So it was really kind of nice because it's a large space. It's about 18 by 19, you know, with tall ceilings and everything. So it's very reverberant. So, of course, I got all my brass ball bearings out and stuff and started rolling across the space. So.
Hardwood floor? Or
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So all that and all the bouncing and, of course, just major stereo enhancement by mic placement, of course. And rolling the ball down, these larger balls. I don't know if you know about these Chinese health balls or medicine balls.
Yeah,
and they have these
yes.
little clangy things
yeah,
in
inside,
there.
Yeah, inside, yeah.
Right, and they're very, very inexpensive, but it's very, very hard to make those clangers seize so they don't clang anymore. So just rolling those down the koto and with steel strings. It wasn't a real koto, but... I just gathered a whole bunch of sound sources out there, and they have sort of a natural reverb built into them, and that forms sort of bookends there, the ball bearings rolling are at the beginning and the koto is at the very end, and then in the meantime, in the middle, is all the gas valve regulator in the
and
the men's washroom.
Let's hear this. Piece from 2002 by Maggie Payne. This is Fluid Dynamics.
Not quite yet.
Hold on there, Maggie.
Just a little bit of business first, and then we can do the fluid dynamics. Let's have a little... ready, Maggie? You there? Okay, here we go.
Hi, I'm Maggie Payne, and you're listening to Cavils and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your one stop for non-pop on the Non-Pop International Network.
Oh, thank you. Beautifully done.
Nicely, professionally done.
Here on WGDR Plainfield.
And the piece?
Well, not yet.
Not yet.
First of all, we have to thank
Jerry
Gerber
thanks,
for
Jerry.
Providing his studio for our interviews in San Francisco.
And his wonderful array of baby foods.
Yes. Jerry Gerber will be our guest on September 25th at long last in his very own studio. And don't forget next week, Stephen Kent, September 11th. Didgeridoo, master. Jeff Alou, a film composer on the 18th of September, and Jerry Gerber on the 25th, and then John Van Zelm Truby, the original crank yanker, rock and roll person, composer, and director of The Ugly Janitors of America.
And a bit of a curmudgeon, is he?
Oh, very curmudgeonly. He will be with us on October 2nd, so that's the next 4 weeks. Thanks also to the Argosy Foundation for helping us make the tour to California to provide the year's worth of interviews we've had. And thanks, of course, to contributions for the last 2 weeks' shows from Noah Krzyzewski and Kyle Gann.
And thanks to JetBlue for not crashing.
Yes, always to them.
I still have one of their packets of Lorna Doone shortbread cookies from last...
Are you going to bring them to festivity here? You could have brought them last night along with the Burns venison.
I could have. Oh, I should have. But now to music.
Yes, here we go. Maggie Payne and Fluid Dynamics.
Fluid Dynamics by Maggie Payne. And we're back. And when you were talking about your studio, that reminded me that you have another life. You have the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde life.
Missed you.
Yes, missed you. The recording and restoration.
Yeah, historical remastering.
Yeah, let's hear
yeah
a
and
about
recording
that.
And
we
editing.
We share that, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Calvos in his other life also does historical remastering.
Can I send you some overload
love those
that
paper
I have?
You may need. We'll conduct our business offline.
Okay. Yeah, I also do recording engineering, like real, I mean, new now stuff as well, which I really love to do. And editing, I've been involved in just literally hundreds of CDs and earlier LPs and stuff. But I got hooked up with this really interesting company, Music and Arts, that does specialize in historical recordings. And early on, you had some tools, EQ and some kind of help for hiss and stuff, Berwyn noise
help
filter and stuff like that, right?
Help for hiss, yes, and that's not all.
But in 93, I bought a Sonic Solutions digital audio workstation, and then the world was just so vastly improved. And it's just, for me, it's so exciting to take these recordings from as early as, I think, 1933, on up to around in the 50s, somewhere mid-50s or so. And to bring these to life again, and I try to have as light a hand as possible. There are a lot of people who just really try to change the sound to sound, like now sound. But so many of these were actually recorded quite well. It's just that they have technical flaws that you have to deal with, and a lot of them have tremendous numbers of dropouts and
Well, you're dealing with enormous different kinds of materials. You'd have paper tape or wire recorders and transcription discs, these
that's
sort of 16
right. acetates
and things that have cut through to the glass.
And early tape and all the stuff. And of all of them, the early tape, it's amazing. They play quite well.
Yes,
they
do.
Yeah. So, but it's dropouts, the missing fragments, the damage, all that stuff to try to correct that. And most of the time you try to correct it by finding a parallel passage, a repeat or whatever, and slugging that in, and hopefully it doesn't have some scar in there that's going to be really, noticeable.
Obvious, yeah,
but
yeah.
Also getting rid of all the clicks and pops and the surface noise and all that stuff. But equalization with a fairly light hand, except, again, for getting rid of all the hum and all that stuff. And, and many of these have been transferred so many times that it's been, transferred originally in Europe, so you get 50 hertz. Hum and all its harmonics, and then
yes.
It comes over here, and then it's at 60 hertz with all its harmonics. Somebody did another dub, and, I don't know how many generations down some of these sources are. But it's so remarkable to hear these performers and to bring them to life again and to have it really, hopefully, pretty listenable and remarkable performances. Just absolutely remarkable. And the thing is, they're in real time. They're not, they're not edited. And I have, I'm happy to edit all the time and stuff, but it's different, I mean, these were performances, and it's great to also work on contemporary things and edit as needed. I love doing that as well, or classical music, whatever, but it's just a different thing, and I'm happy in both worlds,
no qualms either way. Restorations
Are
kind of going out in the desert in some ways.
I
find them fascinating. I do a lot of spoken. And to hear voices that were covered by time come alive.
Yes.
I have to sort of interrupt here and just give a little personal anecdote. Mm-hmm. I had an opportunity for a historical organization in Vermont to do a tape that was recorded on the day I was born in 1949. And to hear a voice that was at a town meeting in Vermont in 1949 on paper tape suddenly go from to the voice coming forward and hearing as if you were in the room.
Yeah.
Such a marvelous experience.
Yeah. It's just so exciting and so wonderful to be a facilitator in that way. I have to say also that I'm on a extensive dream here of archiving all the Center for Contemporary Music's recordings from the 50s all the way up to now, up to transferring them over to CD so that they'll be available for people to listen to.
There's no time. Where's the fun time?
I've done 149 CDs worth of material so far, and that's a little tiny dent, and there may be 15%. There's a lot to go. But, you know, I'm still, as you do all the time, seeking grant money to enable this to happen. Because it's a marvelous archive.
Do you like Rubens have a studio of acolytes who help you do this work?
No, I just really have to do it. The transfers are so critical, you know, and I want a uniformity mm-hmm. to how they're done mm-hmm. and a consistency to how they're done. And I was at most of the concerts from the 1970s on, which is the preponderance of the material. So I also take, you know, anecdotal notes at the bottom of my notebook so that a researcher later will know why Pandit Pranath, for instance, stopped singing 20 minutes into this rock that he was singing. You know, all the sound baffles blew down, and he decided that the gods were telling him it wasn't time.
Yeah.
Wasn't right to be singing. I think he was singing an afternoon raga in the morning or something. I can't remember. And I told him it was morning somewhere. Or it was afternoon somewhere, sorry. But I don't think that worked.
Get back to your own music.
Mm.
And we have one more to play today.
Yeah, that's Breaks Motor, which actually
Breaks
relates
Motors,
to what you
which
were just.
Is fun, yeah.
It's what you were asking about, because Breaks is B-R-E-A-K-S. And what I did was take one of the places that historical remastering engineers go to find out where all those, you know, you got these buzzes and these. Isn't that nice?
And
right when I said buzzes, we got a bell. But you've got all these whines, all these buzzes, all this stuff happening. And one of the places you go to track that down, also to track down hum, and find out the specific pitch of hum, is in the breaks between movements of symphonies or,
right.
or you know,
exactly.
whatever. And so I found...
Where it's exposed and nothing else is disturbing.
Or at least a few coughs or something, yeah. Also can help determine pitch at times, because A440 has not always been A440.
Mm-hmm.
So if the hum is at 51, then I need to sample right down and bring it down to, you know, whatever, right on 50 and stuff, or, you know, whatever. But I decided to loop some of those sounds in those breaks, because they're often really fascinating, very intriguing. So that's part, the breaks part in this piece. It's taking different samples from all these.
Reminds me of the, story, Murky's Collected Silences.
Mm, there you go.
Remember that? It's a story where we're in a future, a past version of a future world in which sound was constant from the broadcasts. It was never to stop. And Murky's job was to cut the silences out and make these things continuous. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name
silence.
Of the author. And he would collect in a drawer
all the silences. Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Which is never silence. There's
yeah,
no
right.
such thing.
Exactly, which is what reminded me of.
Right, and the motors part of this title are these little tiny stepper motors that my partner Brian Reinbold happened to have. He was working on a project with his robotics projects, mm-hmm. and I walked over there, and he had one going. It was going, you know, doing all these little fatty rhythmic things. He said, I'm going to do rhythm this time, right? Yeah, right.
Yes, sure.
So I put them in all sorts of little resonating bodies, you know, an inverted stainless steel bowl, which is really great. Mm-hmm. Got a nice mm-hmm. metallic thing and all the harmonic resonances coming through, and, you know, a wooden box and all this stuff, and recorded that. And it actually does have a little bit of rhythm in this time.
I'm just trying to imagine the bowl. Yeah. The box sounds great.
Yeah, but it's teeny tiny little stepper motor. It's probably about, a half inch maximum. Really cute.
Those are great little things.
Yeah.
You see those of us who work in electronics love these little toys.
Yeah, absolutely. I was supposed to be looking.
Collected silences. We have little collected drawers of motors.
I was supposed to be telling him how great his project he's built, you know, all I was thinking, oh man, that sounds great. I'll be right back.
<microphone comes>.
He knew.
Maggie Payne, we're out of time.
Yep.
And so we're going to play this Breaks Motors, and thank you so much for joining us on Calvus and Damien. It's been a long wait, and we're so happy.
Oh, it's certainly my pleasure.
Just a quick reminder, next week, Stephen Kent, master of the didgeridoo, will be here on Calvus and Damien. And let's just hop right out here for Maggie Payne's Breaks Motors. Till next week.
A production of Multimedia.